I had spent a couple of days hanging out at FTX's offices. I'd sat with Sam. He's answering emails from other CEOs. He's on Slack. He's like doing interviews. And in that time, I didn't pick up any clues. What I was suspicious of was crypto in general. And I would talk with Sam about this, which is that he claimed to be an effective altruist. He claimed that everything he did was so that he could do the most good for the greatest number of people. But meanwhile, he was running what I thought was at best like a offshore casino where people could go gamble on like random tokens and would probably lose their money, which seemed like kind of bad for the world. But what I did not suspect was that he was taking all the money out of the back of the casino, bringing it to other casinos and gambling it himself and losing it. And that when the customers went to cash in their chips, there'd be nothing left for them. You know, I didn't suspect that. And pretty much nobody else did. I don't think anyone can say that they called it.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. Lemon.io. Need to speed up your product development without draining your budget? Hire vetted engineers from Europe at lemon.io. Go to lemon.io/twist to get 15% off for the first 4 weeks. And CLA. Innovation takes balance. CLA's CPAs, consultants, and wealth advisors can help you get from startup to where you want to end up. Get started now at claconnect.com/tech.
All right. You may remember back in 2021 at the height of the crypto chaos, did a little investigation on Tether on this podcast. So we had a couple of colorful characters on the show, including Bitfinex, the anonymous Tether critic. And one of our best guests during that time period, while we were all trying to make sense of what was very clear to a number of us, a grift, crime, and insanity that made no logical sense. Some people had suspended disbelief. Some people were in on the grift. But one of the best guests was Bloomberg investigative journalist Zeke Fox. And Zeke had just published an article titled, "Anyone Seen Tether's Billions?" That was back on episode 1300, 500 episodes ago. Zeke is back on the program because he has a book coming out today, T-O-D-A-Y, today. And I want you to go buy it because it's awesome. I'm listening to the audiobook and this is going to be a classic. The book is titled Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. For the book, Zeke spent a lot of time with SBF before the FTX collapse and with Michael Lewis there. Doing a story on it. And he also purchased a $20,000 Bored Ape to get access to ApeFest. He traveled to El Salvador to learn what happened or what happens when you bet your country's treasury on Bitcoin. And then, quite excitingly, he went to the Philippines to meet a few of the only active Axie Infinity players and so much more. Zeke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back on. I'm really excited.
So you spent the last 2 or 3 years writing this book, and there's so much you uncovered in terms of grift, crime, and insanity. And I guess everybody really wants to start with SBF. Sam Bankman-Fried is now in jail. He's in custody. He's not just charged. They revoked his bail, apparently. And you got to spend time with him. And you saw him at his peak when he had been paying people like Bill Clinton $250,000 to come speak. That's the going rate for presidents these days. Giselle and who's the football player?
Tom Brady, her ex-husband. Brady.
Yeah, ex-husband.
They got $50 million combined, yeah.
$50 million. And then King of the Grift. Who's the guy from Shark Tank who got like 15 million?
Oh, Mr. Wonderful. Yeah. 15 Oof. Million. And I saw him down in the Bahamas at the celebration of FTX polishing his dome with a razor right before he went on TV. I learned some
incredible
tricks. Yeah.
Let's start with that moment, which is very vivid in the book, by the way. You're a great writer, by the way, one writer to another. Really take you to that scene. But take us to that scene where you're staying on one side of the island, Sam Bankman-Fried's holed up in his penthouse, he's having this crazy conference, and all these people are running around celebrating this hopped up on speed, degenerate criminal. And the question I have for you is, while you're watching this as an investigative journalist doing actual journalism, not content creating, but like actually reporting from the field, was it clear to you this person was an absolute degenerate scumbag?
So I have to say, I have to admit, no. Like, I wish I was here to tell you I'm the guy who took down SBF. You know, I could be on like my speaking tour right now as like the hero reporter who exposed the fraud. But I had spent a couple of days hanging out at FTX's offices. I'd sat with Sam. He's answering emails from other CEOs. He's on Slack. He's like doing interviews. And in that time, I didn't pick up any clues. What I was suspicious of was crypto in general. And I would talk with Sam about this, which is that he claimed to be an effective altruist. He claimed that everything he did was so that he could do the most good for the greatest number of people. But meanwhile, he was running what I thought was at best like an offshore casino where people could go gamble on like random tokens and would probably lose their money, which seemed like kind of bad for the world. But what I did not suspect was that he was taking all the money out of the back of the casino, bringing it to other casinos and gambling it himself and losing it. And that when the customers went to cash in their chips, there'd be nothing left for them. You know, I didn't suspect that. And pretty much nobody else did. I don't think anyone can say that they called it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and we've seen this before. Bernie Madoff went for decades. And then even when people started to suspect Bernie Madoff, it took a little while for people to believe some of the whistleblowers. Enron took a little while, and Theranos took a little while. We have a trend here. Sociopathic criminals, you know, deranged people. There's all different kind of archetypes here. But do you think he was did you think at the outset he was trying to be a criminal, or do you think he was just a degenerate gambler on speed who did what people on speed do, which is, you know, get manic? What's your take now after all this information has come out?
So what I think is that he and his buddies were so taken with this mission that they were going to be super rich, make $1 trillion and use it to save the world, that this made them even more dangerous. And they thought that any risk, any illicit activity that it took to get there could be justified. And like, I've talked with people who hung out with them that suburb, like before the collapse, who said that all they were talking about was like the upcoming AI apocalypse and how they were going to stop it. And I've talked with people who knew him when he was a teenager, who knew him when he was in his early 20s. I think his interest in effective altruism, utilitarianism, was sincere. And like I said, like that's what made him so dangerous. And I don't know that when this decision was made, but at some point, Sam and his colleagues at FTX decided that it was worth it to dip into these customer funds to keep things going, because in their minds, the payoff was so huge. Like, there was really a chance they could save the world. They were talking about buying an island nation that could be like a headquarters for humanity in event of like a giant disaster. They were really going crazy with the power that they had.
Is the word that comes to mind to me.
Yes.
So these young individuals who came from a lot of privilege and from Ivy League backgrounds, they're elitists, right? These are elites in our society. You would describe them all as like children of elites?
Definitely. I mean, they all came from, they all went to great colleges, and it's the some of these people, it was their first job. And one thing I thought was really telling was that when FTX collapsed, before any criminal charges came down or anything, the kids that were running it were all gathered in the Bahamas. They were at Sam's apartment. They're crying. They're hugging each other. And a lot of them fled the island and went back home to their parents' house. Like, they never really lived on their own.
If you're a SaaS or services company that stores customer data in the cloud, then you need to be SOC 2 compliant. You knew that. From a third party. And you need that third party to close big deals. And if you want to get compliant easier and faster, you need to use Vanta, V-A-N-T-A. Vanta makes it so easy for you to get and renew your SOC 2. On average, Vanta customers are SOC 2 compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. Compare that to 3 to 5 months without Vanta. And Vanta can save you hundreds of hours of manual work and up to 85% of compliance costs. This is a total no-brainer. And Vanta does more than just SOC 2 compliance. They also automate up to 90% compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. You can't afford to lose out on major customers. We all know that. Listen, it's a hard year. Last year was hard. You can't lose those major customers because you don't have your compliance dialed in. Just work with Vanta. Get your compliance automated and tight is right. Lock down those big deals. Here's the best part. Vanta is going to give you $1,000 off. That's 10 hundies. Get $1,000 off at Vanta.com/twist. That's Vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2. Okay, so just so we're teeing this up correctly, you've got a bunch of kids with elite parents from Ivy League backgrounds who have never worked a day in their life, who are also who are enamored and having delusions of grandeur that they're going to be the ones who save the world. They get involved in gambling and criminal enterprise knowingly. Start stealing the money and start making these crazy bets. But I've sort of brought it up twice here. I'm going to bring it up a third time because you haven't sort of locked into this. And I think it's a key factor because I interviewed SBF and he was shaking his leg. And this is a month before he got pinched, I think, or before all this started to come apart. And he was shaking his leg and moving his arm around and his head and the twitching made me, as an interviewer doing random acts of journalism as a former journalist, and this was in a corporate private setting, I did this interview, I started to feel bad for him that he was having a panic attack, perhaps, because the shaking was out of control. And then I thought to myself, you know what? I know people who've been addicted to speed and amphetamines and Adderall and this stuff. This kid's got to be banging 50 or 60 milligrams of Adderall or something. What is going on? Your body does not shake like that. Did you see that same behavior? Because he seemed to be like a lot of these privileged kids who are around with all these mind-enhancing, performance-enhancing drugs. You know, they've been on them in some cases since school because they're so competitive in going to Ivy League schools and getting into them, that there's a lot of abuse in the system. What role did that play? And did you see that?
So obviously, like when the reporter's around, you know, they put away the amphetamines, but it's been pretty widely reported that a lot of them had Adderall prescriptions. And I think Sam, has complained that in prison, he hasn't been able to get his ADHD meds and has impacted his ability to prepare for the defense. I saw the twitching that you were talking about. It was actually most crazy on stage in the Bahamas when he was with Michael Lewis or then later Bill Clinton in front of this big audience. His legs were tapping so hard that he would like get his hands and try and like hold his leg down.
Yes.
But then like the other leg would start tapping.
Yes, and he was trying to control the shakes.
Yeah, it was his mannerisms were really weird. And I don't know. I don't think I can read into like what that comes from if he's like that when he's not on meds. But when I saw him towards the end, just before he got arrested, when I was at his apartment, he was wearing a t-shirt with like shorter sleeves. And I could see he had this patch on his arm.
The MSAM patch. E-M-S-A-M.
Then this is another weird habit of his, which is that like one of the skills of being an executive is like knowing when to duck a question. So I asked him at that time, like, hey, what's that patch? Is that MSAM? Because I think some people on Twitter have been speculating about it by then.
Yeah, in fact, I just pulled up the tweet for those watching here of him at his like crazy desk with like six monitors as a trader. And instead of it being the 80s and he's doing cocaine at the desk, he's got these MSAM patches all over the desk. Yeah, and these are for epilepsy or something? It's insane.
He said he's depressed. He's prescribed them for depression. But I said, hey, is that just for depression or is that kind of a performance enhancing drug? And like easy answer would be like, I'm depressed. My doctor gave it to me.
Sure.
Like that would have been true. But he's like, well, I don't know. It's tough to say. I mean, does it enhance my performance? And I'm like, oh my God. But yeah, these guys thought they could work, you know, 22 hours a day. They could trade around the clock, trade markets in Asia and the US and in Europe. And Caroline Ellison, his ex-girlfriend and deputy, there's quotes from her on her old Twitter where she said, like, she really believed that, you know, Adderall was a big performance enhancing drug. I don't know if that's what led them astray. To me, I actually think it was their belief in their own righteousness and their lack of experience that led them to take these crazy risks and like illegal and to gamble away the customer's money, which is totally illegal.
Yeah. And these, just so people know, like one of the things that this category of drugs can do, according to my research, and I'm not a doctor, so don't take advice from a podcast or investigative journalist, but these things can really mess with your judgment. They can give you delusions of grandeur and they can make you feel invincible. And so I think that this is a major part of the psychosis of this, a group psychosis that was going on here, because maybe you could talk about the group dynamics here, putting aside like that they had some polyamory thing, who cares? I don't think it's relevant, but there was a manicness to this group and there was this, we're going to save the world kind of ethos that you're talking about. And they seem to know how to hack the system. They seem to understand that if you gave important people money, that they would say whatever you wanted them to say. They would give you their halo to grow your brand. And the cynicism here of like these elites, I think both his parents went to Stanford, right? They're professors from Stanford on
yes,
like ethics. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how they knew how to play the game and this group sort of psychosis. It's a two-part question there.
Well, I mean, it was really clear to me that they'd played the game well when I went to this conference, like you brought up before. I'm coming there. I'm thinking like, all right, it's kind of, I looked down a little bit on this offshore casino and I'm at the conference. I'm hearing about the stupidest ideas like, you know, crypto spaceships that are going to like make us all rich or like pictures of shoes that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like anyone who was at this conference would have known that this was like a world of make-believe, right? Like the assets that are being traded on FTX were mostly like these dumb crypto coins that like, had you evaluated any of them as investments, I would think you would have passed, you know?
Oh, I did.
In this world, yeah.
I literally, you're asking a venture capitalist, I literally did. Somebody said, how did you know that this was all a scam? I said, well, 99 out of 100 of the projects I knew were run by people who were not qualified or they were farcical and insane and they had spelling errors in their like white papers. And white papers is not how we invest in companies. We look at prototypes and actual products. And the person's like, yeah, but you knew. And I'm like, when I say 99 out of 100, I'm actually giving you a number. I met with over 100 of these. That isn't like a made up number. So continue. When did you realize? I'm really interested in your journey here, because you went on a journey. You start to piece together NFTs are nonsense. These people are morons. They've got delusions of grandeur. They're on speed. They're paying people to come here. When do you start to realize, wait a second, Emperor has no clothes?
So I'm sitting there. I'm basically in the Bahamas. I'm basically thinking that, but I'm feeling kind of depressed because I'm like, seemingly so many smart people who I respect have been co-opted to promote crypto gambling. And
right.
I saw like Michael Lewis, he's on stage at this FTX conference put on by FTX to celebrate Sam and like what a genius he is. I'm kind of excited to see like, all right, Michael Lewis, he showed me like how the subprime crisis worked. Surely he's going to have some smart points about crypto. But he's on stage interviewing Sam and he's like, I felt like it almost felt like he was, he was like a school headmaster and Sam was like his star student and he was there to give him a prize. He's like, wow, you're breaking land speed records. You're, you got billions and billions of dollars. Like you're going to revolutionize Wall Street. And then I saw, Bill Clinton up there being interviewed by Sam and Sam was asking him like, this was like a Hall of Fame and his leg tapping. He had prepared like no good questions. It was really embarrassing performance on stage.
And he dressed like a slob. Like, I mean, he was
right
physically unkept. And you're like, so you're saying in your mind, am I the dumb one in the room? Because these are successful, smart people I respect. Michael Lewis, how do you not respect him? This guy wrote Moneyball. This is like one of the smartest, greatest writers of our time.
And
Bill Clinton, hero. Yeah.
I don't want to let the venture capital world off the hook. Like,
no.
Venture capital was funding a lot of these transparently dumb ideas. Like,
at very high valuations.
Yeah. And, Solana was one of Sam's favorite coins. Mm-hmm. I met the multi-coin guy at Sam's conference. And the thing that I realized was, like, the goal, time and again, like, I would ask these crypto guys, what is your thing good for? Like, can I use it? Can I try it out? Because I think that, like, eventually the product has to be good for it to take off,
It's like a basic tenet of business, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, crypto's as old as, like, WhatsApp and Uber.
Yeah.
And, like, we use those every day. And, like, nobody uses crypto. And these guys oftentimes they had nothing to show. Like, the virtual spaceship guy, he was like, oh, yeah, I've sold, like, 300 million of virtual spaceships. And I was like, I love video games. Let's play. And he's like, oh, no. That's, like, years away,
But yeah, in the book you say he's like 5 years from now, but he sold the spaceship, so he just sold people pictures.
I mean,
flip art.
I couldn't believe it, but I sort of thought that Sam had talked his way to the top, and that like I believed he was running this offshore casino, but an honest one, and that maybe like that's what the title of the book comes from a little bit. It's number go up, and it's like the number was just going higher and higher, and it was sort of like, could this number just go so high that these crazy things could turn into reality? Like, I didn't really believe it, but it was like, I didn't think, oh, the crash is coming next week. Like, it was truly weird. I felt like I was living in like a alternate reality for, a couple of years there.
But at some point, being a business journalist, a finance journalist, you are aware of what a Ponzi scheme is. And Ponzi scheme is the oldest form of grift, I think, in the finance world. I'm trying to think of one that's more prevalent or more well documented over time. And it's clear this is a Ponzi. The new money coming in is paying off the old folks. And there's no there, whether it's Madoff or it's, whatever, one of these Fugazi crypto video games or NFTs, it's obvious. And there's no regulation in it, which was disturbing. So Ponzi's must crash. The question is when. When does the Ponzi crash? And the Ponzi did crash, but you also found out that there was this rails of the internet, of the crypto space. And the rails of the crypto space were something called Tether. And last time we were on the pod, we talked about Tether. And this was obvious to all of us. Listen, if you've got tens of billions of dollars that you've collected, and you really have it, you would do what's called an audit. And then they were telling all of us that we were crazy. They did an attestation. And we all go look up what an attestation is. And it's like, oh, that's a screenshot of like a bank account with a certain amount of money in it. But it is no way comparable to an audit. Imagine this. You got an idea for a tech startup. You're going to change the world. I know it. But you got a problem. You don't have any engineers. Engineers, hard to come by. They're very busy. They got jobs backed up. Well, you need to find great engineers. You need to find them quickly. And you need to reduce your burn rate, right? Because you can't be spending like a drunken sailor. You have a limited amount of resources as a startup. Now imagine, there was a partner out there waiting to help you who had 1,000 on-demand developers, and they were vetted, experienced, results-oriented, and passionate about helping your startup grow. And what if they charge competitive rates, you know, reasonable rates? Does this sound too good to be true? Well, you need to head to lemon.io right now. Startups choose lemon.io because they only offer handpicked developers with 3 or more years of experience with strong portfolios. And if anything goes wrong, lemon.io will replace your developer as soon as possible. A bunch of launch founders have worked with lemon.io. They've had great experiences. So here's the call to action. Super easy. To learn more, go to lemon.io/twist to find your perfect developer or tech team in 48 hours or less. And Twist listeners get 15% off the first 4 weeks. What a deal. So stop burning money, hire a developer smarter, and visit lemon.io/twist. Easy peasy. Lemon squeezy at lemon.io/twist. So maybe a good point for us to pivot to now is these insane people running Tether and meeting them.
Yeah. And so Tether, when I started looking into it, the company seemed to be quilted out of red flags. Like, I'd never seen a weirder company. The top executives never gave interviews, rarely even seen at these types of conferences, and it wasn't clear what country the coin was based in. They wouldn't say where their money was. One of the founders was a child actor who had been in the Mighty Ducks. The one bank I found that would own up to holding some of Tether's assets was owned by the guy who created Inspector Gadget. And like when I was on with you last time, I had found that Tether, while it said its reserves were in super safe assets, had invested a lot of the money, billions of dollars, into loans to other crypto companies and Chinese commercial paper. So like at that point in time, it seemed to me like there could be a run on Tether any day because like if you're an investor and you've got your money in Tether, I mean, you don't want to be the one who's holding these Tether coins when something bad comes out. Yeah. But it didn't happen. You know, and I started to wonder, like Tether, even in 2022 in the summer, when these companies started falling one after another, Celsius, Voyager, Gemini, FTX, like Tether held up and people redeemed billions of dollars of Tether. And if they didn't get their money back, like they would have complained, right?
Right. It was basically stress tested at a certain point where I think 5 or 10 billion came out of the 70 or 80 billion that they had. So we have red flag. We have so many red flags, and they've also been banned in Canada. I believe they got banned. They got banned in New York State. So you do have some legal action and people and regulars saying, you know, we don't want this around because we see red flags, but they kept telling us we're all crazy. Some redemptions happen. So then you got to think like, what's happening here? What are the possibilities of what could happen? The only one I came to was, well, maybe they did a bunch of fugazi stuff, but unlike what FTX did, FTX took the money and lost the bets that he was making on the side. Maybe Tether was doing things that wouldn't pass regulatory scrutiny, but the bets worked out for them, i.e. maybe they just put everything in Bitcoin and it had a run up and they just had all the cash. So what did you discover there? And you got to meet some of these crazy lunatics, yeah?
Yes. So I went to the Lugano, Switzerland twice to try to track down Giancarlo Di Bassini, the boss of Tether. He is a former Italian plastic surgeon who then got into like the low-end computer import-export business. And what I went to this, his girlfriend, it turns out what your theory is not a bad one because he's like a real Bitcoiner. Like he's one of these Bitcoin kind of cultists, I think.
Maximus, I think they call them. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Like, he's not a big social media guy, but he'd have the laser eyes on there, I think.
For sure.
He goes to El Salvador, hangs out with President Bukele, who's made Bitcoin legal tender. And his partner is a Bitcoin artist who makes this really, like, kitschy art that's, like, pictures of Satoshi or, like, a dollar bill, but George Washington is screaming because, you know, central banks will be replaced by Bitcoin. So she was having I heard she was having an art show in Lugano, and I thought this would be like the time to track down the reclusive boss of Tether. So I flew out there.
Let me ask you a question. Do you fly out there on your own dime, or does Bloomberg believe in investigative journalism so much that you come to him and you're like, you know, I need some tickets. I need to go somewhere. I don't know when the story is going to come out. And how much do they spend on these articles you write, and how often do you file? And tell me about that process. Or do you do it out of your book advance? I'm curious.
So Bloomberg is game for whatever. They are great about this sort of thing. I'm glad, though, that I did not have to ask them for some of this book stuff, because, like, I don't think they would have covered my $20,000 mutant ape out of the expense budget. Or, like, the second time I went back to Lugano, they're like, because I didn't find Giancarlo the first time.
Oh,
the second time I went back, I did track him down. But, like, I wonder what the editor would have said. And then this gets into another theory about Tether, which is that maybe some of the users are up to no good. They don't really care because they're like crooks themselves. And to investigate that, I ended up going to Cambodia to a town run by Chinese gangsters. Where
this part of the story, like, is like your Indiana Jones going here. These are towns that are controlled by the Chinese mafia, where you can get in, but you can't get out. And explain these call centers and the vibe there. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like some sort of like QAnon thing, but basically, if you get one of those spam text messages that's like addressed to the wrong person, there's a decent chance it's sent by someone who has been trafficked to Cambodia or Myanmar. The UN estimates more than 100,000 people have been victimized this way. They're held in these towers. They can't leave. They're beaten. They're forced to send these spam messages all the time. And if they hook someone and become friends with them, they run a crypto scam on them. They convince them to send in their savings because they're going to make lots of money on this great trade. And they always use Tether. Now, I don't think like the Tether guys have anything to do with this, but Tether with this stablecoin has created this amazing way that like some lonely retired guy in Indiana can zap like $100,000 to a Chinese gangster in Cambodia, and like the money will never come back. And Tether's gotten so popular and accepted that one thing I found really telling, I never see any like Tether stuff in the United States or anywhere else that I traveled for that matter. But when I got to Cambodia, I was at the entrance to one of these most notorious sites of crypto human trafficking called Chinatown in Sihanoukville. And right at the entrance, there was a shuttered money exchange store, and I could see on their sign that they're advertising that they traded USDT for cash. And I found lots of other stores like that in Phnom Penh and was able to trade USDT on my phone for US dollars, no questions asked. And like, it doesn't prove anything, but I felt like I discovered, oh, this is what crypto's good for. This is why.
This is why the United States wants you to know your customer, and we're enforcing regulations here, because if you don't enforce regulations with money like this, bad guys in Cambodia who are doing human trafficking and crimes can use it as like an anonymous way, or a very fluid way. It's kind of quasi-anonymous, but a very fluid way to move money around.
Yeah, and some of these guys, just bring it full circle, some of these criminals would then send their Tether. I talked with like blockchain analysts who are tracing their accounts, and they could see that the Tethers would end up at regular crypto exchanges, including FTX. And on that like last visit to Sam's apartment just before he got arrested, I was like, you know, he loved reporters. He would talk to reporters. I had to leave because I was getting tired because I didn't have any drugs. But we were running out of stuff to talk about with his predicament, and I was like, Sam, have you ever looked into this? Like, your exchange is being used by these criminals. They're like scamming people. They're trafficking workers from across Southeast Asia. And he was just like, huh, that's like really bad. I don't know like what we can do.
And you can shut their accounts off. You could know your customer. I mean, there's like a thousand things you could do.
And, right. But I felt like that was the attitude I saw in crypto in general. Like the people who created Axie Infinity, this like disastrous play to earn game that was popular in the Philippines. You don't see them apologizing to all the Filipinos who lost their money. You don't see the A16Z guys who funded it and who I think did pretty well, acknowledging what had happened. And like the crypto people are happy to create some crazy scheme and to watch the token go up. And if you get in early, if you're the guy who made it or like one of his buddies, you can do great, even if the scheme doesn't really work out that well in the end.
All right, everybody. Stephen Estes is a principal at CLA, Clifton Larson Allen. This is a professional service provider that specializes in CPA, tax consulting, and wealth advisory. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So you specialize in VC-backed high-growth startups. What's an overview of how you advise these companies in the early stage, and then what typically gets complicated as you go?
First and foremost, I'd say CLA exists to create opportunities for our clients, our people, and our communities. And we do so by taking an industry-specialized approach, becoming experts in our respective industries. And that really enables us to identify those kind of opportunities and spot issues before they become problems. We work with a variety of companies in the tech space, right? From incubator all the way up to IPO and through the exit. So we generally will come alongside them and partner with many of the early stage companies right when they come out of an incubator, and then kind of expand that relationship as those companies scale and grow. And we come alongside and assist with like fractional CFO work, audits, M&A assistance, international, and really just kind of help those companies throughout their entire life cycle. It's our promise to know you and help you that really enables us to transition from being just an accountant to a trusted advisor.
Get started right now at claconnect.com/tech. Let them know your boy Jake Howell sent you. claconnect.com/tech to get started right now. So you yourself put yourself in harm's way in Cambodia in these like crime-filled towns. So tell me a little bit about that.
So, okay, I don't want to like overstate it because there's reporters who are like in Ukraine right now, like embedded with, you know, the Ukrainian
bombs
arm,
can land on their head. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, this wasn't like, basically I teamed up with two reporters in Cambodia, Mek Dura and Danielle Keaton Olson, who they were super brave. Without like the kind of institutional support that I have, they had exposed this problem for this tiny publication. And instead of getting journalism prizes, the president shut down their newspaper and was like, let's just ban reporting. There's very little independent press there anymore. So they took me to Chinatown, where it was really spooky because I'd met with victims who'd escaped from these places. So I'd heard what went on inside, and I'm there and it's like these brutal, like office towers, these dingy gray towers. I'd heard this, it's like a whole kind of office park that holds like maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people total. And these towers, each room has like a balcony, and they looked like maybe they were built to be nice, but there had been bars welded on the balconies to turn them like into cages, because otherwise people would jump to try and get out.
Oh, wow.
And so the wildest thing was there's a hotel in the middle of this that looks pretty nice. And I had heard from victims who escaped that hotel was where the bosses would go to like sleep with prostitutes. But at the time I got there, it was listed on booking.com and like appeared to be open. So I was like, I got to check this out. So I walked in and, you know, the management's all Chinese. Not everyone speaks English. They're definitely giving me weird looks like,
yeah,
what is this guy doing here? It's got the lobby. It's a nice looking hotel. The lobby has like this 8-foot tall golden pineapple. I go up the marble staircase to the buffet. Nobody's here. It's like a ghost town. And when I get to the restaurant upstairs, which looks great, it's like you could host like a 500 person wedding there. There's nobody there. And the host is sort of like confused that anyone has walked in, to the point that like he doesn't even really have an established system for how to charge people who are customers. Like, as far as I could tell, this is like the buffet for the bosses who are running these like scams. And so I'm sitting there. They're like, there was a fridge in the back with free beer. Yeah. They had Budweiser, which I like. Yeah. And so I'm chatting with one of the waitresses who does speak English. And I play kind of dumb. And I'm like, what's with this place? Why is nobody here? And she's just like, this is Chinatown. And I'm like, you know, I know what that means, but I'm like, what's Chinatown? She's like, listen, like the people here, like they can't come and go. Like they can't come to the restaurant. And I'm like, I make this like this face of horror. And she's just like, she was like, oh, but don't worry. The wait staff, we have our freedom. And I was
forget
just like,
it, Jake. Oh. It's Chinatown.
Yeah. I was just like, first of all, I was like, oh my God, this is I can't believe this is real. It's so horrible. Yeah. And also I'm sort of left with like, where do I go from here? Like the Tether investigation, you know, started back when we first talked. I'm like going to the Bahamas, talking to, you know, their banker. It seemed kind of silly. Now I'm here. I'm like, oh, this is like enabling, whether the Tether guys know it or not.
Oh, they
this
know
is
it.
Enabling. Yeah. Yeah. Well, they do now.
Well, and it's designed, let's be honest, it's designed for this use. It's designed to not require, you know, anybody to know what's going on, to know their customer. It's meant to be fluid. It's meant to be frictionless. It's meant to be permissionless. And so mission accomplished. And they know full well that if you make something that's permissionless and frictionless and, you know, to whatever extent less traceable or untraceable, you know who's going to be attracted to that.
Yeah, definitely. And it comes up in criminal cases from time to time. I saw one where this like Russian money launderer was talking. There were intercepted communications that the FBI published. And he's just like, he's talking to a client. He's like, yo, get USDT. It's like, you don't need to say your name or anything. It's so fast. It's awesome. Everyone uses it. And like, but where we leave things at the end of the book is that these guys are not in trouble, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And they've got now, it used to be you had to do some crazy gambles to make money if you were sitting on $50 or $80 billion. Now you can invest it in treasuries and earn 5%. That's what they say. That's what they say they're doing. And if you believe their numbers that they're publishing now, they are earning like $1 billion or more per quarter. Tether's one of the most profitable companies in the world, like more than Nike. It's a small crew that runs it. They're all billionaires now. Yep. Like they come out ahead as like one of the of all this crypto carnage. Like they're the winners at the end. And it was certainly not what like anybody would have predicted, I don't think. And
one point, I'm looking at their quarterly reports because now they're releasing quarterly reports like they're a public company, I guess, to dunk on everybody who thought they were committing crimes. And listen, they were committing some crimes. They were, you know, prosecuted in certain areas and banned from certain areas. But if they have whatever it is, $80 billion in assets, you put it in treasuries, you make 5% on that. That's $5 billion a year, you know, $4 billion a year. It's a lot of cash.
Right. That's like a great business. And I've reported that they were under investigation by the US DOJ for bank fraud. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, like no charges have been announced. It's been years. Mm-hmm. I find it unlikely that they will just grow and grow and Tether will one day like replace, you know, JP Morgan and the government will just say, you know, I didn't really care so much about banking regulation and know your customer rules and whatever. Let's just let somebody else hold billions of dollars and move it around with these tokens. But I don't know what's going to happen.
It's wild. I mean, it's somehow, you know, as you go through this book here, there's like massive risk-taking, fraud, crime, and then some people figure out a way to go legit maybe. And so you had this happen in organized crime in American history where you had people who, you know, were committing all kinds of crimes. And then at some point they flipped over and like, you know what, let's be legit. Let's stop running numbers, prostitutes, drugs, whatever. And let's get into construction concrete. Let's try to, you know, own buildings or whatever it happens to be. And I think, you know, if I'm just taking a pure guess here, I think Tether, yeah, might be in the process of doing that. And that's why they've avoided the full audit, right? They don't have to do a full audit.
Right. Well, there's no real regulator, so they can do what they want. And they still say the audit's coming. They've released this attestation, which honestly, I mean, it's fairly detailed. Like, if you believe it's released by an auditing firm, at some point it becomes kind of the real Tether truthers are always saying like they haven't delivered the proof, but it's like, I don't know, they've made it this far. Now they have the, like we've said, they have this way through buying treasuries where they could be making billions of dollars. It could be that if there was a hole at one point, they've earned it back by now.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
That's the likely scenario. I think that's a distinct possibility is that, you know, and imagine if instead of FTX and SBF spending their money, giving $15 million to Mr. Wonderful to go on CNBC. And I don't think they let him on CNBC anymore after all this. Like, I don't know what the fallout is for people. Do Giselle and Tom Brady have to give the money back? Does Mr. Wonderful have to give the money back?
So I think most of these people got paid in equity. So they may not, unless they were able to sell it, they may not be, they may not have anything to give back.
Got it.
And, you know, now we've got like maybe the top five people at FTX have been arrested or pleaded guilty. And a lot of the people who worked at FTX kept their money on the exchange and lost all their money. Yeah. So, and one thing I thought was pretty funny was that there was another crypto Ponzi that we haven't talked about yet called the Terra Luna.
Yeah, no, I had Do Kwon on this podcast and he couldn't explain to, I had him on. I'll send you the episode after we get off or just do Do Kwon, Luna, this way. And I kept asking him, can you explain it to me one more time? There's a Luna, it's pegged to this, but then there's like money coming out. Where does that money come from? And, you know, I consider myself somewhat sophisticated in terms of investing in 400 companies and, you know, putting $100 million to work or whatever and getting returns for investors. And I couldn't understand, like, where is that? Where are the profits coming from? And it's like, well, you know, they're staking. And I'm like, well, who's on the other side of the stake? I don't understand. So yeah, maybe talk. And he's pinched. He got picked up in, what did he get picked up? Montenegro or something, like a Von villain or something. It was like Monte Carlo. It was some place with the casinos. He got picked up.
I think it was Montenegro. Yeah. But he was still doing like Twitter spaces, you know, like the occasional live stream while he was on the run. Yeah,
who picked him up? Daniel Craig?
There was this one guy who had called Terra Luna and made a lot of money on that. And then he lost his money because he kept it at FTX. and this gets to like the one question that comes up a lot with writing a book about crypto is people are like, where's it going from here? And to me, I'm like, did you watch the last 2 years? Yeah. Like, this is some of the craziest stuff that's ever happened in the history of finance. Right. Are we just going to like memory hold that and be like, you know, Trump. Now it's time to.
It's exactly like Trump. It's like this got out of control. It makes no sense. And because the crimes were so rampant and so frequent, people have given up. It's literally how the KGB does PSYOPs is that if there's so many crimes, it just becomes the default, right? I mean, I think people just have become inoculated to how heinous and insane these crimes were.
But said it like, even if we're talking about the ones that were not crimes, that were just like crazy bubbles, do you think that like in the VC world, this could ever get going again? Like, what's the, how is the...
It depends on, so bubbles will always happen. And that's like actually a good part of the ecosystem. We overinvest. And then some big winner comes out and you have a duopoly and, you know, Uber beats Lyft and Lyft has some amount and DoorDash and you got three or four players in that space now. So you do have these boom bust cycles and that's fine. But people flaunting the regulations in finance, I haven't seen any VCs who have been taken to task over investments or clearing of positions. And it might be because if they didn't clear their positions, you know, a lot of people have, you know, talked about Andreessen Horowitz, which is, you know, they were kind of the lead investor in a lot of these companies. I don't know that, you know, if I think they may have done Axe Infinity, but whoever did Axe Infinity, right? Put a
they,
bunch
they
of
were into, yeah, yeah, they were the lead investor in that, I believe.
So if they put $100 million into it and lost it, I don't know that they committed a crime. It's not a crime to lose your money on an investment. If they put $100 million into it and they sold all their equity and they distributed $400 million to their LPs, at some point, does somebody come knocking on the door and say, was this a security? And, you know, Gensler has been kind of strong about what he believes is a security. And so there needs to be some sort of regulation here. You cannot trust a bunch of smart people with tons of money and you give them an unregulated casino, bad things happen, period, full stop.
Yeah. And if people were being offered, you know, tokens at a discount with not much of a lockup, like I can see why a venture capitalist might say, sure, I don't care about, you know, give me the Luna tokens. As long as this keeps going for a few more months, I'll be able to dump them on some sucker.
Yeah.
And like you said, I haven't seen cases come out like that, but I'm kind of find it hard to believe that no one did that. And I also agree that, the SEC has basically come out and said that a lot of these, pretty much most of these things probably were securities and that the laws would apply. So I'm waiting to see what cases do come out of it. I think they're going to be digging through this for like a decade or, 5 years. I think that's their statute of limitations.
And, you know, there are regulations around when you can liquidate tokens and who can invest in companies. We have accredited investors. We have qualified purchasers. These are sophisticated folks. It's about 6% of the country. They're allowed to invest in these things. If you were involved in Axe Infinity or an NFT program and you knowingly sold to the public, or you didn't put the controls in place for the other 94% of non-accredited investors, non-qualified purchasers to invest, that's a pretty serious crime. Doing a unregistered secure, you know, selling securities in an unregistered fashion like XRP did. And so, or I believe XRP did, and the government believes they did, and pretty obvious they did. The only thing that's not obvious is it an actual security?
It was like for a couple of years, just like no one cared about the rules. Like when I was there at Ape Fest, the Yuga Labs, which is the company that created the Bored Apes, like the ugly monkey pictures, they had just announced the creation of ApeCoin, which was like a useless coin that didn't do anything, but maybe they could use it in some metaverse that didn't even exist yet. And they're giving people ApeCoin. It's trading on Coinbase. People are making tons of money. For some reason, it still has some value on Coinbase. People are making tons of money. I'm at the conference, which is like a party on a pier in the South Street Seaport in Manhattan. Snoop is performing, and he's singing a song. I don't know how this didn't get on the internet, but he sings a song that's like, ApeCoin, like, don't buy Dogecoin, buy ApeCoin. And I'm like,
sounds like promotion.
Do you own any ApeCoin? Yeah, like, do you own any ApeCoin? Like, is that going to be disclosed in like the third verse? Like, this is
the third verse,
like,
is pump and dump. I say pump, you say dumb, pump, dumb. I mean, it's literally laughable how crazy this was. And, you know, the SEC, I know, was looking at Yuga Labs back in 2022. I don't know.
I broke that story because I was talking to somebody else in crypto. I asked them about Yuga and they were like, oh yeah, we were going to do like a deal with them, but they got some like big problems with the SEC. Meanwhile, the person I was talking to, I'm like, you're doing the same stuff. Aren't you going to have problems with that? You're not worried about this? But like,
I think people suspend disbelief. You know, this is what I've learned, and they convince themselves whether they're high on speed or they're high on their own supply. Does not matter. The book is incredible. Zeke Fox, Number Go Up, Inside Crypto's Wild Rise and Staggering Fall. I could talk to you for hours, but I don't want people not to buy the book. You got a taste of it. The stories are even crazier. I'm 2/3 of the way through the book. You're a great writer. You're a great investigative journalist. The book's important and it's very entertaining. I hope they make a movie out of it for you or a TV series or something. Did you get optioned yet or no?
No.
Somebody optioned
Michael Lewis has got his 5 million. Mm-hmm. I just read. So
oh, really?
Mine, okay. You can have mine like a lot cheaper.
Yeah, just, yeah. Give me a 1 million. Go ahead. Just get let's get a million to Zeke and go buy the book right now. Audiobook's great. Congratulations, Zeke. Yeah. And the story is, you know, you're gonna have to do a follow up because I think we're only halfway through the story. We'll see you all next time on This Week in Startups. Bye bye.